Finn looks across at her.
"What happened?" he asks.
Jess shakes her head in response.
"Did he throw you out?"
"I didn't want to put him at risk," she mutters. "He doesn't deserve to be a part of this mess." She keeps quiet about the real reason, the shame of Nav's words still hot inside her. Griffin starts the Land Rover and puts it into gear.
"Last of the good guys, eh?"
he says to himself. "You wouldn't understand. You're not like Nav." Jess turns away and looks out of the window into the darkened streets. She realizes what she's implied, that the risk to Griffin doesn't matter. But Griffin shakes his head.
"No. No, I'm not," he mutters in reply.
Chapter 21. There's no way the investigation is quiet anymore. It's exploded into a full-scale manhunt. Other constabularies are being drafted in. Multiple investigations have to be combined. Kara knows the chief constable is having a coronary, shouting at anyone within contact. Kara's taken control, allocating actions and tasks to the new detectives in the operation. She now stands outside the block of flats, watching the flood of scene of crime officers begin their work. Libby has arrived with a flash of pink hair and a smile to Noah. Dr. Ross is already inside. Despite the late hour, journalists and TV crews hover around, desperate for a crumb of a quote. One shouts for her attention from the outer cordon. She knows him, Steve Gray from the Chronicle, but she responds with a no comment and leaves him disappointed. They've only shared the theory with a handful of people so far. Libby, Ross, a few other detectives. The press have no idea just how bad things are. Kara knows a statement needs to be made, but what would it say? "We have a serial murderer on our hands, one who has killed more than 10 people, and no, sorry, we have no idea where he is." She watches Deacon in the doorway. He's talking animatedly on the phone to the team back in the station, reiterating her orders, a cigarette burning down to the butt between his fingers. He'd handled the sight in the flat better than she had, but he'd been shaken. And angry. She knows the signs. The furrowed brow. The twitchy hands. Her phone rings and she looks at the number. She answers it.
"So we have Adama,"
Griffin says. "News travels fast."
"How many victims?"
"At least 10. But all in pieces. All in varying states of decomp, so who knows for sure."
"And the neighbours didn't notice anything?"
"They're taking their statements down at the station now," Kara says. "So far they've just said they noticed a smell and complained, but there was a note through their door that said there was a rat problem."
"Pretty big fucking rats. Did they keep the note?"
Griffin doesn't wait for an answer.
"I'm coming down there."
"You'll do no such thing. I'm serious, Griffin. Come to the station first thing in the morning, but I don't want you here. Not now." She pauses. "The place is crawling with journalists, Nate. They'll have a field day if they see you." She hears him pause. He knows she's right. She sees Deacon indicate to her from the door of the block of flats. "Listen, Nate, I have to go. I'll see you tomorrow, okay?" There's another pause.
"Okay."
Kara hangs up and takes a deep breath. She follows Deacon back into the building.
"I don't know what you need me for,"
Dr. Ross is saying as Deacon and Kara approach the main living room. "There's fuck all I can do here." His voice is strained. Kara's not surprised. It's not how she wants to be spending her evening either.
"We found body parts in the freezer, both the one in the fridge and the freestanding one next to it. There's more in the closet in the hallway, and what we think is a complete skeleton in the bedroom. Most have been dead for quite some time. He's been killing for at least a few years. Although there's one recent in the bath, looks strangled, probably within the last 12 hours. And no, we won't know exactly how many bodies there are until we start piecing it all together." He turns away from them. "Literally."
Deacon leans forward, looking at the DVDs under the television. Return of the Jedi and The Exorcist too.
It hardly seems real, does it? He mutters to Kara. I mean, what does this guy do? Dismember people in his kitchen and sit back and watch Star Wars?
Kara shakes her head and looks around the room. In the corner is a black table, and on the top, a fish tank. In all the squalor, it stands out. It's spotlessly clean. A variety of tropical fish swimming around inside.
If only you could talk, she whispers to them.
She follows Deacon out and they go into the bedroom again. The metal cabinet has been emptied and a paper bag rests in a box, ready to be taken away as evidence. Deacon picks it up and pulls something out with his gloved hand. It's dark skin in a long roll.
We think that's a penis, a voice says from behind them.
Deacon swears and drops it back into the bag. They turn.
Libby is there, recognisable from her black eyeliner.
I kind of like the idea, she says,
her eyes creasing in a smile behind the mask.
I think I'm warming to this guy.
What else can you show us, Libs? Kara asks.
Libby points to the blue plastic drum.
We haven't opened that yet, she starts. We'll take it away as is, along with the freezer. But if this guy is copying Dharma, we'd expect to find some human torsos in there.
Deacon trails behind them as they walk into the kitchen.
He didn't use much in here for preparing food. Formaldehyde, ether and chloroform found in the hallway cupboard. Acid and bleach in here.
She holds up evidence bags, showing them each one in turn. Large hypodermic needle, drill and 1/16-inch drill bits. Kara doesn't like to think what they might have been used for. Libby continues.
We've emptied the bin, some scraps, fragments of paper. Not sure if it's anything useful, but we'll go through it. Blood evidence across all surfaces. We'll take samples. Fingerprints. Some blood spatter up the walls. I don't know what else to tell you, detectives, except this is one fucked up puppy.
And one that's good with knives, Dr. Ross joins them in the kitchen. To dismember this many bodies in this way, we're looking at someone with a decent knowledge of human anatomy.
The same guy as Monday night? Kara asks.
Possibly. We'll compare the tool marks used on both. I'll send you my report when I know more, Ross concludes.
Kara and Libby enviously watch him leave, desperately wanting to do the same. Deacon has wandered off to another part of the flat.
Are you still on for drinks? Libby asks her.
Kara looks at her doubtfully.
At this time of night? She points to the busy scene. With all of this going on?
I know a place.
A night shift takes over in half an hour, Libby says. What more can you do here, really?
Kara shrugs.
Don't you think you could do with a bit of downtime?
Libby's got a point.
Kara's phone starts ringing.
Fine, 30 minutes, she whispers to Libby as she answers it.
It's Shenton.
Anything from the mother? Kara asks.
No, she says she hasn't seen Michael Sharp in about a year, but we'll follow up. She might be holding out on us.
That's great. Good work, Toby, she adds, trying her best to be encouraging. They need the boost. It's nearly 11. She hasn't eaten since lunch. She could do with someone giving her a good pep talk now.
Outside, Deacon has changed out of his crime scene suit and is smoking around the corner of the block of flats, out of sight of the reporters. Kara joins him and reaches out to take his cigarette, but he holds it away from her.
Rue will kill me if I let you smoke.
Just give me the sodding cigarette. Let me worry about my husband, Kara says. I think I'm allowed one after the day we've had.
He raises his eyebrow but hands it to her. She takes a long drag before passing it back.
You ever known anything like this before?
He asks her. She shakes her head.
Thankfully, no.
You?
He blows out a cloud of smoke.
Some with the drug squad. Bits and bobs with SO10, he says, giving her the cigarette again.
She knows what he's referring to. SO10,
the old covert operations unit within the Met Police, one of Noah's early postings. She goes to hand the cigarette back to him, but he waves it away.
"Finish it,"
Deacon says. He leans back against the pebble-dashed wall of the flats, closing his eyes for a second. They stand together in silence, and Kara realizes how much she appreciates him being here with her. In these moments, when something truly horrible like this happens, nobody outside of the police force could ever understand. On his first day in Major Crimes, Noah had arrived with a severe grade one haircut, tight shirt, skinny jeans, and a battered pair of blue All-Stars on his feet. He had the build of a greyhound on speed and the metabolism to match. And he'd called her Kara. Not boss, not DCI Elliot or Gov, like the other detectives in her team. Certainly not ma'am, a term she hates for making her feel about 50. Noah had requested a transfer and she had read his file. Undercover until 2014, drug squad since, with accompanying plaudits, and she had agreed without hesitation. But this man, she had thought on first sight. He'd had a detachment about him that Kara had mistaken for arrogance, and she'd wondered if she'd made a mistake. But she soon learned none of her other detectives were like Deeks, and that was a good thing. Unconsciously, she'd found herself gravitating to his side. They'd go on call-outs together, and she'd single him out to ask his opinion. He was serious, quiet, and worked harder than anyone else there, herself included. Their partnership became the norm. Where DCI Kara Elliott went, DS Noah Deakin went too. Deakin pushes himself up from the wall. He puts a hand on Kara's arm, then leans forward and gives her a hug. She's surprised by the sudden contact, but realizes that it was just what she needed, and for a moment rests her head on his shoulder. He smells of some sort of soap or washing powder, an aftershave she's always liked, and polo mints. He pulls away from the hug and offers her one now. She takes the sweet out of the packet and pops it in her mouth. "I'm going to head off," she says, breaking the silence. "Do you want a lift?" He shakes his head.
"I'll stay and keep an eye on things," he mutters.
Kara knows any attempt at persuasion will be useless, and she knows how Noah is feeling. That restlessness, coupled with despair at their lack of progress. But Libby's right. There's nothing more she can do here. She needs to let SOCO do their job, to log and take samples and process, and hope and pray that this guy has made a mistake. Because God knows, she thinks, as she looks up at the bland block of flats, knowing the horrors behind its pebble-dashed walls. This bloodbath is enough. Chapter 22. Jess hears the phone beep, then senses Griffin get out of bed. She opens her eyes and watches him in the darkness, his head bent, talking on the phone in hushed tones. He is just in his boxer shorts, and she appreciates the sight, then wonders, who is this guy and what is she doing here? When they got back earlier, they hadn't talked. Griffin hadn't offered her food or drink, just taken his clothes off and climbed into bed. She'd paused for a second, then done the same, her presence in this flat seemingly now implicitly accepted. Nav had been worried about her being there, and she knows he had been right to be. Griffin could be anyone. But she feels like she knows him. Deep in her psyche, she recognizes something. The damage. The desperate search for the intangible. He's pretty much twice her size, but since that first night, he's never done anything that has made her worry. But perhaps her bar is just low, she thinks. Perhaps she wouldn't know danger until it hit her square in the face. Griffin finishes his call and gets back into bed. She can sense he's still awake. He's twitchy, fidgeting. "Another one," she says, and he turns to her. He nods. She sees his face through the darkness. "Does this mean Patrick's murder is definitely linked?" Jess asks quietly.
"Nothing's definite, Jess,"
he says.
But maybe.
He rolls away from her and she shuffles down under the duvet, lying on her back, staring at the ceiling. She needs to do something to forget about this. The anxiety, the impatience, waiting for the bomb to drop. She can feel the warmth of his body next to her. She wants to touch him. She wants to. But she can't. She balls her hands into fists. She knows that sex with Griffin would make her feel better, if only for a moment. But after the rejection last time, she couldn't cope if he did the same again. She needs to gain some control, even if it's just over her own body. Jess takes a long breath in, then gets up and goes to the bathroom, closing the door behind her. She blinks as she turns the light on, then sits on the cold lino floor, leaning forward and opening the cupboard below the sink. She finds what she's looking for and puts it next to her. A new razor blade, still in its packet. She's only wearing a t-shirt and knickers, and she pushes her bare legs out in front of her. Inside, she feels like a collection of tiny pieces, fractured and broken. So why shouldn't the outside look the same? She picks up the razor and breaks it in half, freeing the blades from the protective plastic shell. She drops the rubbish on the floor, then holds one blade between two fingers. She can feel her hands shaking. Slowly, she puts the sharp edge against the top of her upper thigh. She sees the scars from previous times. Some no more than silver lines, others still red, barely healed. She pushes and draws the razor across her leg. She feels the blade puncture the skin, slice into her flesh. Blood blooms, runs down her leg. She does it again. She knows how hard she should push. Enough to make it bleed, but not so much that she needs the hospital. After all, she hasn't got Nav anymore. She feels tears running down her face, dropping onto her leg, mixing with the blood. She knows what she's doing is destroying her piece by piece. But it's punishment for being such a fuck-up. Punishment for not being normal. She counts. 7. 8. She knows she'll stop at 10. 10 is always enough to release the tension, to open the safety valve of the pressure cooker. That or finding some random man to do what they do so well. But like the razor, the sex never appeases for long. The initial excitement of attraction, the endorphins of a quick fuck. They're a rush, a distraction from the squalling in her head, but once it's over and the man has gone, she's back to the same screwed-up mess that she was before. She'd always wondered if Patrick knew. If he had, he'd never said anything. And she had dismissed his indiscretions too. The woman whispering in his ear with a smile and a glance her way at the Christmas party. The calls late at night that Patrick took from another room. She didn't blame him. She wasn't a good wife. She wasn't a good anything. The door opens, pulling her away from her thoughts. She looks up. Griffin's standing there, squinting in the light. He swears, dropping down to his knees next to her.
Fuck, Jess, what are you doing?
He leans forward, taking the toilet roll and bundling up tissue, pushing it against her leg, trying to stem the bleeding. Then he stops for a moment and Jess watches him take a long breath in, staring at the floor. He looks up and slowly holds out his hand. She drops the razor blade into the ball of bloodied toilet paper. She's expecting anger, disappointment, judgment, fear. All reactions she's seen before, from her parents, from medical professionals, from her husband. But Griffin seems different.
"Do you want to tell me what's going on?" he says.
His voice is serious but calm. Jess shakes her head. Griffin opens the cupboard again and takes out an old box of plasters. Silently, he does what he can to stop the bleeding, covering up the cuts one by one, balking at the mess. He glances up at her every now and again as he works, as if expecting some sort of complaint about the pain. But she just watches him, impassively. When he's finished, he sits back on the floor, cross-legged. She's still leaning against the wall, her legs in front of her.
"Do you want to talk to someone about it?"
he asks. She shakes her head again.
"No." "Have you? In the past?"
"It didn't help."
"Okay."
She sees Griffin looking at her. His gaze moves to the bandage on her head, then back to her leg. He knows something's up, she thinks. I should just tell him. But she's aware that once people find out, their perception of her shifts. They treat her differently. And after what she's just done with the razor, there's enough going on for the moment. Griffin looks away and he sighs, thinking. Then he stands up, holding out his hand. She takes it and he pulls her to her feet. Her legs feel wobbly.
"Well," he says, almost more to himself,
guiding her back into bed, turning the light off.
"What a fucking state we're both in."
He lies down next to her in the darkness, pulling the duvet across. She listens to his breathing, to the cars outside on the road. Every time she thinks she's got the measure of Griffin, he proves her wrong yet again. She must have fallen asleep because when she wakes, she's curled up next to him, skin touching skin. She moves away, embarrassed at what might have seemed like affection. He's asleep, and Jess looks at him in the dim light. All his features are relaxed, his usual frown gone. She pauses. She wants to know more about Griffin. Her curiosity digs at her. She pads across to the table where Griffin has left his bag. She scrabbles around in the pockets, glancing back to the bed to make sure Griffin is still sleeping. There's his laptop, printouts, a few photos, all in the main compartment. Wrappers from some sort of energy bar, screwed up receipts. She turns her attention to the side pocket and pulls out what's in there. She looks at it. It's a small white box with OxyNorm written on the front. Oxycodone hydrochloride below. She pulls out the blister pack. Small orange capsules that she has seen Griffin take on more than one occasion. Jess doesn't know anything about pain relief, but she's heard of oxycodone. They're strong, addictive. She looks at the box. There's 8 left. She frowns but replaces it in his rucksack. Her attention turns to his jeans, discarded across the sofa, and she picks them up, feeling the pockets. There's a wallet in one side and she pulls it out, looking at the cards. Nathaniel Griffin, so that's something. It's his actual name, at least. She puts it back, then something in the pocket attracts her attention. It's a photograph, slightly crumpled, of Griffin and a woman. He has his arm around her and he's smiling. Jess realizes that in the time she's known him, she's never seen him smile like this, and she looks closer. His hair is shorter, he's clean-shaven, handsome. He looks happy. Her gaze drifts to the woman next to him. She has long, dark hair falling softly over her shoulders. His arm is tightly around her and she's leaning into him. And then Jess realizes. She goes to the table and scrabbles through the crime scene photos until she finds it. She looks at the photo that was pinned on the board, then back to the snapshot in her hand. She stops, her hands shaking. No wonder it's personal for Griffin. No wonder he's a man on a mission. The woman that was raped and murdered, this is her. And the husband left for dead? It was Griffin. Chapter 23. The bar is packed. Kara can't believe how busy it is at this time on a Wednesday night. She hovers in the doorway, looking through the throng. She can't spot Libby. She should be going home. She's so exhausted even her eyelids ache. But just as she is about to text her excuses and leave, she sees Libby push her way towards her.
Come on,
Libby says, seeing her expression. Let's get you a drink. Two glasses of wine down, and Kara has spilled her guts about the Kemper postmortems, the Manson murders, all the details about Griffin's theory. Kara knows her expression echoes Libby's. Lowered brow, downturned mouth. There is nothing good here.
But I can't help thinking, Kara adds, downing the last dregs in her glass. Why do it? Why go to all the effort of copying serial killers?
Adoration? Infamy? Recognition? Libby replies. With one hand, she signals the barman who replenishes their glasses.
Why does any multiple murderer kill? You can't apply normal logic. Have you thought about getting a profiler in?
Marsh would never approve the budget.
Worth an ask?
Libby stops, thinking for a moment.
And what does Noah say?
Kara pauses, a smile creeping onto her face.
Why is it with you, Libs? The conversation always finds its way around to Deakin.
Libby pushes her long pink hair out of her face.
Just interested, that's all. And anyway, I don't need Noah, she says with a grin. I have a date on Friday night.
Libby opens up her phone and shows Kara the profile on the dating app. Kara nods in approval.
But why did you two split up? Kara asks.
Libby sighs. She puts her phone back in her pocket.
Ask Noah. Not my choice. He didn't tell you.
Kara shakes her head. I thought you two talked about everything.
We talk about murders and rapes and bad guys. We don't talk about his love life, and mine's too dull to mention.
Libby looks at her, then tilts her head to one side.
What? Kara asks. You know, I always thought there was something going on between the two of you.
Between me and Noah? Kara laughs. Why?
You spend all day every day together. You're always whispering in dark corners, laughing, like a little impenetrable club.
Kara snorts and Libby takes a swig from her glass.
You're saying you've never thought about it?
No.
Not even once?
No, Kara repeats. Well, maybe, once.
Ha! Libby throws her head back, gleeful. I knew it.
You should, you know. She raises an immaculately arched eyebrow.
You'd like it.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Libby stretches the word out into one long syllable.
Man's dirtier than an ex-nun at a flea bag convention.
She waves over Kara's shoulder.
In a good way, she adds,
then stands up to say goodbye as one of her friends goes to leave.
Kara watches her, chatting and laughing on the other side of the bar.
They were well suited, Kara had always thought, Libby and Noah. Both unconventional, but both unmistakably attractive. They'd looked good together. But he'd called an end to their relationship, and Kara wonders why.
And why is she so interested?
She sips at her wine, already feeling woozy as the alcohol goes to her head. But it's nice, this fug, helping her forget the violence and the death in the time-honoured manner.
Libby swings back onto her bar stool, crossing one elegant leg over the other. She flashes a mischievous grin.
So, she asks Kara, shots? And then, without waiting for an answer, beckons the barman over.
An hour later, Kara finds herself rolling out of the taxi at her front door. None of the lights are on. She knows her husband will be in bed, needing to be up early in the morning for the breakfast service. She opens the front door, putting her keys on the hook as quietly as she can in her alcoholic haze. She takes her coat off, her shoes, and puts them away.
She'd have liked someone to talk to. About other things than murder and dead girls and dismembered body parts. But settles for making herself a bowl of cornflakes and eating them in front of an old episode of Friends.
She leaves the bowl in the sink and turns the light off again, going upstairs. She pauses outside the door to her daughter's room, then pushes down the handle, opening it quietly.
Inside, the stars on the ceiling highlight her face in a hazy glow. Tilly's sleeping. Her hands tightly grasped around a small white owl, now grubby and worn from years of love. Kara rearranges the duvet back over her, then crouches by the side of her bed. It's a parent's worst nightmare to hear the news that too many families had received that week. Your child is dead, and not only that, but their last hours would have been scary and painful. They would have most likely begged for mercy, prayed for their mothers, and their last thoughts would have been for the ones they loved. Kara looks at the sleeping face of her daughter and feels the anger eating away in her stomach. Losing a child from illness or an accident is tragic, but this senseless taking of a life, of so many lives, is unconscionable. It's inhuman. For the first time that week, she feels tears rolling down her face, then swallows them away, wiping them dry with her sleeve. Kara leans forward and kisses her daughter on the cheek, and she stirs. She opens her eyes and looks at her. "Go back to sleep, Pickle," she whispers.
"Did you catch the monsters?"
she asks.
"Daddy said you weren't home because you were catching the monsters."
"Always, my love."
"What do they look like?"
Tilly's eyes shine in the darkness.
"Daddy says they look like you and me."
Kara silently curses her husband. "Yes, but I'm trained, so I can always tell the difference."
"Is Josh a monster?"
Kara smiles, tucking the duvet around her. "No, as much as you think so, your brother isn't a monster."
"Is Daddy? Is Noah? Is Uncle Nate?"
"No, we don't have any monsters here, Tills. I got rid of those long ago. Now go back to sleep." She nods, satisfied with her answer, and closes her eyes, rolling over in bed, taking her owl with her. Kara gets up and goes into her own room, cleaning her teeth in the ensuite in the dark. She doesn't want to look at herself, to see the effects of the day on her face. She takes her clothes off and climbs into bed, pushing up against the back of her husband. He mumbles something incomprehensible. "Rue," she whispers. "Are you awake?" She knows he's not, feeling guilty for wanting to wake him up. But he stays resolutely in slumber, and she envies her husband's ability to sleep. Kara rolls away from him and lies on her back, looking at the ceiling. She waits for the tiredness to overtake her, for a blissful oblivion she knows will never come. Chapter 24. It's early morning, still dark, when the pain wakes him. Griffin shifts in the bed, testing out the extent of the problem, then slowly sits up. It's nothing he's not used to by now, and he stands tentatively, making his way towards the kitchen. The flat has cooled, and he feels the chill on his skin. He gropes his way towards his bag, pulling out the box of pills, swallowing two down quickly. He's not a good guy. Griffin's always known that. He took no offence to Jess's earlier words. It's just how he is. Even when he was new to the police force, he wasn't one of the shiny, fresh recruits, turning up eagerly, their shirts ironed, their boots clean. He'd be out the back, cigarette in hand, when he should have been reporting for duty. But he was the one they called when a scroat didn't want to go into his cell. The person they sent single crewed to a dodgy area. He got into fights, broken bones and black eyes littering his record. He got the job done, and if that meant a few more pounds spent by the NHS, so be it. He'd barely scraped through the written exams, but he'd made it to DC and then to Detective Sergeant. He forged alliances with both the good guys and the bad, traded favours, commanded respect. And then it all went wrong. He walks back to the bed and sits down, the mattress moving with his weight. Jess shifts slightly in her sleep and he looks at her. He's glad she's back. He doesn't like to think about why, But when he heard her voice at the end of the phone, he didn't hesitate. Just got in the car and drove her back here. He feels protective towards her. A connection. Especially after what she had just done to herself. Her husband, his wife. Both killed by the same man, but it's not only that. He knows how Jess is feeling. The propensity to self-destruction. The constant sense of failure. He knows how it is to be different, to not live in the same world as everyone else. Even before it all happened, he had looked at people going about their normal lives. Men in the supermarket with their kids, driving to work. And the majority of them looked happy. How was that even possible? Were they just not aware of the shite in the world? The injustices, the problems, the worries? Griffin came to accept that maybe they're not the ones with something wrong with them. Maybe it's him. But it means that he can look at these crime scene photographs, these dead bodies, and not blink. It doesn't keep him awake at night. Not that, anyway. He accepts that death and destruction are what he's there for. He lies back down next to Jess and pulls the duvet across. He gets a waft of warm body, slightly stale, slightly sticky, but somehow reassuring. He's still not sure why she came back. In his darker moments, he used to question Mia's love, ask why she was with him, despite everything he did wrong. "I am safe with you," she'd say, curling up like a cat next to him. "I'm yours. You're mine. I know you'll always look after me." But he didn't, did he? Not when it mattered. He stares at the ceiling in the darkness, waiting for the edges of dawn to start to take hold. For the day to properly begin, all vestiges of sleep gone. With what they have discovered, his resolution burns brighter than ever. He sees what this psychopath is doing. He knows he will catch him, and he knows he will make him pay. Whatever it takes. Day 4. Thursday. Chapter 25.
Jeffrey Dahmer, convicted of killing 17 men and boys between 1978 to 1991. Particularly fond of dismembering bodies with a little bit of rape and necrophilia on the side.
Griffin is standing in front of a screen, images projected onto the white, a group of nearly 20 detectives listening to him. This is the side of him Kara knows so well. Confident, unflinching.
Known for drilling holes in people's skulls while they were drugged and pouring acid or boiling water inside, supposedly to create walking zombies.
He points to the crime scene photos as they flash across the screen.
"We believe we have found 11 bodies in various states of decay, all echoing Dharma."
Noah whispers next to her. How did that many people go missing unnoticed? "Probably the same way that the victims of Dharma did," Kara replies. "People on the edge of society, the homeless, the unemployed, men estranged from their families." Kara silently resolves to find out their names, every last one. Griffin moves along the whiteboard.
"Peter William Sutcliffe, otherwise known as the Yorkshire Ripper, convicted of murdering 13 women. Our killer managed 2.
He clicks the button in his hand, and a gory image is displayed on the screen. Kara has seen it before, in the crime scene photos, but projected up in front of them, so huge, it is guaranteed to make even the hardest detective flinch. She rubs her eyes. She's hungover, knackered, and the day has only just begun. Damn Libby and her tequila. She barely remembers being asleep last night, knowing she saw 3 a.m. roll around on the digital clock, still awake. But she must have drifted off, as her husband woke her, his alarm bursting into life, ready to do the breakfast service at the restaurant where he's head chef. He'd kissed her on the cheek as he got out of bed. "Back for dinner tonight?"
"I hope so," she'd mumbled back.
After trying to scrape a few more hours of sleep, she'd heard the front door go as their nanny arrived. Lauren, a woman barely into her 20s, seemed to have her life together in a way Kara could only watch and envy. Kara could hear her laughing with the kids as she got them ready for school. Perhaps if she had a different job, she'd be like that too. Endless patience, boundless energy. A lithe body that hummed with vitality and warmth, rather than feeling worn out at the age of 39. Kara had crawled out of bed into the shower, roughly drying her hair and tying it out of her face in a scruffy bun. Her daughter had leapt into the room and bounced on the bed, watching her.
Lauren says, do you want porridge?
Kara had glanced at the clock, about to say no, then saw the hopeful look on her daughter's face. Yes, please, she replied, and went to join her family in the kitchen, scraping a few moments of normality and innocence before the horror of her day began. She pulls her attention back to the incident room where Griffin has clicked the button again.
Manson, he says, then pauses. The stabbing and shooting of 5 people on Monday night.
Kara hears gasps from the room.
Including 1 pregnant woman.
But Manson wasn't a serial killer, Shenton whispers next to her. It was Tex Watson, Susan Atkins and Pat Kremwinkle who carried out the Tate murders. Kara glances across to him. Let's not get caught up in semantics now, Toby, she replies. 5 people were killed. I'm not sure how much rational thought can be applied to what's going on. Deacon leans forward.
I think you should tell him, he mutters,
nodding towards Griffin. But Kara stops Shenton just as he's going to speak. She glares at Noah. Don't wind him up, Deeks, she hisses. This is hard enough as it is. Kara knows there is no love lost between her brother and her partner. Both are passionate, stubborn individuals, but while Griffin does what he wants and to hell with the consequences, Deacon likes rules, procedures and processes. And she knows Noah is pissed off with Griffin taking the lead on this briefing. At the heart of it, she thinks Noah is probably annoyed for not noticing the connections himself. To add insult to injury, Griffin has moved on and is talking about Ed Kemper.
In 1972, he picked up female hitchhikers, taking them to isolated areas where he would stab and strangle them, then dismember and dispose of the bodies. He was caught after killing his mother and fucking her head in 1973.
Kara winces at his language. She's going to have another word with him.
Like Kemper, our killer used a Ford Galaxy. Like the word pig written on the wall and the American flag for the Manson murders, even down to the fish tank and the DVDs in the Dharma flat, he uses details similar to the real murders.
So he's taunting us, one detective asks. Showing off. Griffin looks back at the projector.
He's certainly trying to say something.
Kara sees Griffin turn away from the room and take a deep breath. She knows what's coming next. He clicks the button and an image appears on the screen. She feels her muscles tense. The room is silent. Griffin clears his throat.
Other victims. Other murders we believe are connected.
It's a photo of Mia, her sister-in-law. But here she's barely recognisable. Her body is lying on the floor, her hands tied, half naked. Her long brown hair is over her face, and there is blood, blood everywhere. It's a crime scene photo from just over a year ago. Kara remembers the day. She'd been deployed to a knifing at a shopping centre, staring at the CCTV when the call came over the radio. She hadn't seen Nate that morning, but that wasn't unusual. They were on different teams. Deacon had put his hand on her shoulder.
It's Griffin, he had said, his face dark.
They'd raced to the hospital, stood at the window to the ICU, looking at his unconscious, beaten body. Doctors spoke to her, but she hadn't taken it in, until she'd turned to them and said, Where's Mia? She'd liked Mia from the moment she'd met her. The first time, a weekend away at their lodge with Rue and the kids. Their retreat in the countryside, away from the bustle of Rue's kitchen and the grim nature of her police work. Griffin had arrived late, as usual, and he'd seemed jumpy. Her cocky younger brother, nervous. But all was explained when he introduced the beautiful woman at his side. Kara had realised that this one was different for Griffin. This one was going to stay,
Mia was dark, with a smile that lit up her bottle-green eyes. She'd held Tilly, a baby at the time, and talked about children in her future, giving a quiet smile to Griffin. Mia brought out a side of Griffin that Kara adored. He was calmer around her, happier. He was in love. For once in her life, Kara didn't need to worry about her brother. Until that day. And now here he was a year later, standing in front of a brutal image of the body of his wife. Griffin pauses. Everyone is quiet. Kara knows the majority of the detectives will make the connection between the bloody image on the screen and the man standing in front of it. He clicks the button again and an image of Griffin's old living room appears, the room trashed, blood on the walls and floor.
"This was the attack on a married couple last year, raping the wife and bludgeoning her to death. The husband was beaten but survived."
"Could the husband identify the killer?"
Heads swivel to face the guy speaking. He's new, over from West Yorkshire, so probably isn't aware. Kara sees the woman next to him, nudge him and frown. Griffin's jaw clenches. Then,
"No,"
he says at last.
"There was no useful information from the husband."
Kara stands up. She gestures to the man next to the door and he flicks the lights on. Everybody winces at the sudden illumination. She stands in front of the group. Griffin moves away to the back of the room.
"Right, so now we know what we're all dealing with," she says, taking charge.
There's a huge number of detectives now, following multiple lines of inquiry, not to mention the army of PCs and PCSOs asking questions out on the streets.
"We know this guy has killed over 20 people so far. For the avoidance of doubt, we can assume he will kill again, and he will do so brutally and without remorse."
She points to the photo of Michael Sharp on the board.
"For the moment, unless evidence tells us otherwise, this is our prime suspect. His blood was found at the Kemper crime scene and the Dahmer murders were staged at his flat."
She starts allocating jobs to the various groups around the room.
"Those of you here from constabularies across the country, I want you to swap cases. Get the teams up to speed with what you know, then leave them to it."
She sees the glances between detectives.
"This is not about assigning blame. This is about putting fresh eyes on a murder case. Shenton," she says, pointing towards her DC. "You seem to know a lot about serial killers. Research everything about our murders so far and put together a list of the most notorious serial killers out there. Something might pop up that links to another case. And Campbell," one of the new DCs nods in acknowledgement, "follow up with missing persons. I want these victims identified." She finishes the briefing and the room is filled with noise, energy, conversation, people eager to get on and catch this guy. She gestures to Griffin.
"You okay?"
she says, and he nods. He's not, but she knows he won't want to be asked about it again. "Fine. Listen, Nate," she turns to her brother. "If you're going to be here on this investigation, I need you to keep in line. Don't ruffle any feathers. Don't piss anyone off." He tilts his head to one side, smiling slightly.
"I'll do my best."
"Do better than that, because this is my job on the line too. No one else will take you. Marsh has made it clear you're my responsibility, so if you get fired, I get in trouble. Clear?" He nods, raising one hand in a mock salute.
"Crystal, Gov."
"Good. Deeks!" she shouts across the room, and Noah comes over. Griffin scowls. "And you need to apologise to Noah." The two men glare at each other. "I'm serious, Nate. Apologise. Because I can't have you two working together like this." And there it was, the reason for his suspension. Tensions running high, late at night. No progress made on Mia's murder. Griffin barely out of hospital, and an observation from Noah towards Griffin.
"Maybe you shouldn't be here." "Maybe if you were a better cop, I wouldn't need to be."
And then the final comment.
"Maybe if you'd been a better husband."
Noah had regretted it the moment he'd said it. He'd later confessed to Kara. But by then, Griffin had punched him full in the face, breaking his nose. Griffin frowns at Kara, then sighs.
"I'm sorry for punching you,"
he growls, but you were a prick.
And you, Noah. Let it go.
Only if I can return the favour.
For crying out loud, Kara mutters under her breath. Men. Fine. If Griffin behaves like a prick, you have my permission to break his nose, but don't do it where anyone can see.
Deal.
Deacon holds out his hand, and Griffin reluctantly shakes it.
And I am sorry for what I said.
Griffin nods briefly in acknowledgement. Kara rolls her eyes. Now go and do something useful. Griffin heads off and Kara looks at Deacon. She shakes her head. Tell me it was a good idea to get Griffin in on this, please.
Noah gives her a withering look.
His hand subconsciously goes up to his nose.
It wasn't, but we might as well make the most of it.
As much as I hate the arrogant wanker, he's good at what he does. She sees his gaze shift to the whiteboard.
So, what's next for us?
Kara closes her eyes for a moment, then opens them and looks at him.
Let's keep going with Kemper and Dharma, she says. She shakes her head.
I can't believe we're calling them that. Even with everything she knows, this case still seems surreal. But the reality can't be denied. The facts are there, on the board, in black and white, and blood red.
Chapter 26. Jess heard the alarm sound that morning. She'd feigned sleep, watching Griffin get up and go into the bathroom from under half-opened eyes. She hadn't wanted a conversation after what she'd done last night. In the cold light of day, she'd felt the shame, the prickle of her foolishness. She'd shifted under the duvet and put her hand down to her thigh, feeling the plasters, the scabs, the sticky blood where the cuts hadn't healed. She'd heard the shower stop and the bathroom door open. Griffin had come out, a towel wrapped around his waist. He'd seen her watching, a flash of self-consciousness passing his face before he'd continued getting dressed. Boxers, jeans, sitting on the bed to do socks, then his heavy black boots. He'd pulled on a t-shirt, then a hoodie over his head. He hadn't looked much like a police officer. She liked that about him.
You gonna be here when I get back?
He'd been standing facing the mirror, trying to smooth his hair down, and had said it without turning her way. If that's okay, she'd said. He'd smiled very briefly, and Jess had noticed him trying to suppress it.
No problem,
he'd replied. But now the flat is silent and Jess feels unsure. The worry is back. The uncertainty about what her future might hold. When Griffin's there, his presence is reassuring. His quiet confidence. The solid mass of him has been grounding her. But now he's gone, she feels the jitters return. She should be at home with Alice right now. Watching cartoons. Eating breakfast. Patrick would have been telling them off for getting crumbs on the sofa. A lump builds in her throat and she swallows it down. She has to think about something else. Focus on working out who started the fire. Who did these other murders? She gets up, puts clothes on, and makes a mug of coffee. She cradles it in her hands, sitting down at the table. Photographs are still scattered across. Notes, newspapers, Griffin's laptop. She picks up a newspaper in front of her, buried under a pile of crime scene photos. It's from Wednesday, yesterday. Pages turned inwards, an article clear on the top page. Arson murder suspect runs, she reads, fingers trembling. Jessica Ambrose, 29, under suspicion for the murder of her husband, Patrick Ambrose, who died as their house caught alight on Monday night, has fled the General Hospital against doctor's orders. Patrick's parents, Cynthia and David Ambrose, plead to the public to be on the lookout for their son's alleged killer, saying that their daughter-in-law was a little strange. There was always something not quite right about her. Jessica is not believed to be dangerous, but members of the public are asked to call 999 if they know of her whereabouts. She swears under her breath. She wants to tear it into tiny pieces, but settles for throwing it on the floor instead. It flutters down, pages falling in a satisfying mess. Her eyes shift to one of the photos on the table. She picks it up, staring at the face of the dark-haired woman, Griffin's wife. This photo shows her smiling, in happier times, and Jess recognizes the green and silver crescent earrings dangling from her ears, the one found on her doormat. Jess pulls the laptop closer and logs on, opening up Google. It's basic research. The cops must have done at least this already, she thinks, as she types in, woman, rape, serial killer. But she does it anyway. An insane number of results appear on the screen, each as brutal and graphic as the last. She frowns and tries again, this time arson serial killer. And a name pops up at the top of the search engine. Bruce George Peter Lee. She clicks on the Wikipedia link, reading the page. Then, with one line, her breath catches in her throat. Pouring paraffin through the letterbox. She needs to tell Griffin. This is it. The connection between the other murders and Patrick. She frantically looks around for a phone, a landline, and eventually finds one buried under a pile of clothes. Jess pulls the scrap of paper from her pocket and dials. He answers, his voice gruff, and she gets straight to the point. It's Lee, she says. Look it up. This proves it. This proves it wasn't me. They have to let me see Alice. There's a pause.
I've worked that out already, Griffin says. But it doesn't prove anything.
Have you told your sister? What does she say? Jess pushes. Silence again.
I'll mention it, he mutters.
And the link too. Jess stops herself. The earring, she continues.
I'll mention it, he repeats, and hangs up.
Jess listens to the empty handset for a second, then slowly lowers it from her ear. After the excitement of her discovery, Griffin's response feels like a massive anticlimax. She stands there, alone in the cold, empty flat, bare feet, dirty clothes. She feels the void. She misses her family, her daughter, her husband. And, the dead phone still clutched in her hand, she starts to cry. Chapter 27. 10 minutes, the voice on the end of the phone says, then hangs up. But Kara doesn't need to know any more. She sighs, pulls her hair away from her face, then lets it down again, wondering what to do with it.
You know what Mum would say,
Griffin says, standing in the doorway to her office. Kara smiles. Don't scrag it back.
Exactly. And put some lipstick on, you look a state, he mocks,
then smiles, coming in and sitting on the chair in front of her desk.
Listen, Kara.
Enough of this shit between you and Deakin, seriously, Kara interrupts.
No, it's not that.
He hesitates.
We need to talk about the fire from Monday. I think this is Lee, an arsonist from the late 70s.
He hands her the file. Kara knows what he's referring to. But Taylor said this is different. Don't they have a suspect? She asks. Didn't the wife do it, then abscond? And how do you know about it?
I have an alert on the system. It flags up when there's a suspected murder, he says,
and Kara rolls her eyes.
And you know what Taylor's like. Couldn't arrest the right person if the offender shat in her lap. And besides, I don't think it was the wife. Look at the points of the case. You have paraffin poured through the letterbox. Mia's earring found on the doormat, another sign of the killer messing with us. And the evidence against the wife is circumstantial at best. Fingerprints on a watering can that even Taylor admits was probably taken from the garden shed.
So why has she run?
She doesn't trust the police. She was scared, terrified they wouldn't let her see her daughter again.
This is just conjecture, Griffin. How can you be so sure? Then Kara realises. Oh, shit. Oh, Nate. You know where she is.
She didn't do it, okay? He whispers. Please keep it between us.
Nate, you can't be hiding a suspected murderer. Kara glances out into the incident room. Especially not with you back here. Where is she? Is she at your flat?
No. How stupid do you think I am? He says.
But Kara sees a look pass across his face. Exactly that stupid, she knows.
Just include the case, and if it doesn't fit, I'll bring her in.
Haven't we got enough to do? We have few enough resources as it is. But Kara gives an exasperated sigh. Fine. Just between us, look into it, but leave Taylor on it too for the moment. I don't want to assume that everything's linked.
Griffin goes to leave, but Kara leans forward and catches him on the arm.
Nate, keep me up to speed, okay?
He nods and leaves.
She groans quietly under her breath. She hasn't got the energy for this. For her brother harbouring a potential criminal. She decides that for now she'll let it go. She'll pretend she doesn't know. She stands up and leaves her office, watching the rest of the detectives hard at work. This is the part of her job she loves. The buzz in the room. A shared purpose. Everyone working together to bring in a result. For a brief moment she allows herself to feel confident. They will catch him. Then another thought. They have to. Deacon comes up next to her.
What was all that about?
He says, watching Griffin. Just another case he thinks will fit. His gaze shifts to the far side of the room.
Rue's here for you, he says.
Kara turns and sure enough her husband is standing in the doorway of the incident room, a uniform by his side. He's in jeans and a jumper, she guesses on his way back to the restaurant. She goes over to them, greeting her husband with a surprised kiss.
Lauren says you left your phone this morning, he explains,
handing it to her. She takes it gratefully.
So, this is you?
He asks, gesturing through the door to the whiteboard.
Afraid so, yes, Kara replies. You saw it on TV?
It's all anyone is talking about.
He pauses.
And I've just had a call from the school. Tilly's been sick.
Shit, Kara mutters under her breath. There's a pause. She doesn't know what to say. There's no way she's leaving right now, and her husband knows it.
Can Lauren get her? She asks.
She's got the afternoon off, Rue says,
then sighs.
I'll call her. I'm sure it'll be fine.
I'll be back for dinner, Kara says, trying to appease her husband. I promise.
That'll be good. I'll bring back something from the restaurant. Noah coming too? He asks.
Kara looks into the incident room where Deacon is now talking to Shenton.
I'll make sure he does, she replies. And Rue? When this is over, let's go away. Take the kids to the lodge, somewhere quiet. I don't mind. All Kara wants right now is some peace, sleep, good food, spend some time with her husband. He smiles.
That would be good.
Then she sees Marsh gesture to her from down the corridor. Two fingers, pointing away. It's time. She quickly follows Marsh through the station, and as she goes, she feels the usual guilt. The burden to be all things. Mother, wife, detective, partner, sister. Her daughter isn't well, and here she is, facing potentially the most shocking multiple murder case this country has ever known. She sighs. If she will do only one thing tonight, she will be home in time for dinner. But she can't think about that now. She knows where they're going, and it's not something she's looking forward to.
Just keep quiet. I'll let you know if I need you to talk.
Marsh pauses at a set of wooden double doors.
And if in doubt, say no comment.
He pushes them open. The noise hits them immediately. Conversation, shouting, jostling for attention as they walk through the throng of journalists to where the chief constable is waiting. Flashes from the cameras make her blink.
Fucking vultures,
Marsh mutters to Kara as they both take their seats at the front. Kara does what she is told and stays silent as Marsh raises his hands above his head.
Quiet,
he shouts.
Shall we get started?
The room is bland and boring. White scuffed walls, dirty blue patterned carpet. They've shifted from their usual nicer public relations setting to this one, but even so, it's standing room only. Kara has never seen anything like it. Every seat is taken, the press pushing forward, desperate for even small snippets of information. Slowly, the hubbub dies down and the press conference starts.
As I'm sure you're all aware, at approximately 4:15 yesterday afternoon, police raided a flat on the west side of town, where detectives discovered the remains of what we now believe to be 11 adult males in various states of decay.
"Is it a serial killer?" one journalist shouts, followed by a barrage of questions from the others. Marsh raises his arm again, frowning.
"We believe these murders were all committed by one perpetrator, yes."
Marsh is visibly sweating, a reflective sheen across his forehead. "And is that perpetrator a guy called Michael Sharp?" Marsh glares at the woman.
"No comment."
"Were the bodies found at Michael Sharp's flat?"
"No comment."
Eyes drop as journalists scribble. Kara knows that to these guys Marsh's response is as good as saying yes. "Have you managed to identify the victims?"
"Not yet. We have contacted all the next of kin that we can, but inquiries are ongoing. Any concerned relatives should contact the helpline number on the press release you have been given."
"DCI Elliot, can you confirm the rumours that these murders are linked to others across the country?" Kara glances to Marsh, but before she can answer, another journalist shouts from the crowd.
"Can you confirm the Echo Man is copying murders from notorious serial killers?"
The room falls silent. Kara recognises Steve Gray from the Chronicle as all eyes swivel his way.
"What did you say?"
Marsh hisses.
"That's what they're calling him?" Gray continues. "Because he's echoing murderers from the past."
Breath stops in Kara's chest.
The wall of noise and cameras bursts into life again.
She swears under her breath. This isn't good. The one thing they didn't want to happen. He has a name now. The Echo Man. Part 2.
Hampshire Chronicle, the 20th of February 1996. Shocking stabbing as brothers murdered. A murder investigation is underway after Hampshire Constabulary were called to a house on Millmore Way at 7 a.m. on Monday. Neighbours raised the alarm after seeing a child emerge from the house covered in blood. On entering the property, they discovered local brothers, Gary and Marcus Keane, stabbed to death in the upstairs bedrooms. The child, 9, who cannot be named for legal reasons, was unharmed and is now in the care of social services. Police have yet to issue a full press release, but sources state both brothers were confirmed dead at the scene. It is also rumoured the bodies were mutilated, with their genitalia removed. Both brothers, unemployed, were notorious in the community with alleged links to drug and paedophile gangs. No arrests have been made, and police are not currently looking for anyone else in connection with the deaths. However, an unnamed source within the force was keen to add that there is no cause for alarm and no risk to the general public.
Chapter 28. Griffin's watching the press conference on the screen in the incident room. He sees Kara's reaction as the moniker is spoken. The Echo Man. He knows as much as they try to contain it, that's it. Out in the world. He doesn't like this new development. And Griffin can see neither Kara nor Marsh like it either. Naming a serial killer gives the perpetrator a sense of importance, a level of infamy shared by other murderers of the past, the Son of Sam, the BTK, the Green River Killer. He sees the other detectives glance his way.
"I don't want to hear that name uttered by anyone here," he says to the room. "You hear me?"
And the detectives nod. But he knows his warning will be useless. Police love a nickname as much as the press.
"D.S. Griffin?" A voice distracts him. He just wants to be left alone for a moment. He's worried about Jess, about what happened last night, and he needs to gather his thoughts, try to stop thinking about Mia. But the D.C. has sidled up, hovering behind his chair.
"Just Griffin," he replies. "What?"
DC Toby Shenton, Sarge. He sits down. I had a thought about something. About your case, actually. And I wanted to... I just...
Get on with it.
Griffin growls. Shenton puts three photos on the desk. Griffin glances at them.